WVW Broadcast Network and The New American are pleased to present The New American TV with your host, Rebecca Terrell. This broadcast is committed to helping you understand the truth behind the news. And now, here's your host, Rebecca Terrell.
Welcome to The New American TV, where we bring you the truth behind the news. Today is Tuesday, February 14th, and we'd like to wish you all a happy St. Valentine's Day. Here are some of the headlines we're following. There are new items on the NATO agenda. Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg held a press conference yesterday. He described a surveillance arms race between China, Russia, and the West.
Where China, but also Russia, are increasing their intelligence and surveillance activities against NATO allies. That highlights the importance of our vigilance, our increased presence, and also that we ramp up and step up how we share intelligence and how we monitor and protect our airspace. Sharing more data, collecting more data also from commercial satellites, and then sharing that with the NATO command structure.
Stoltenberg expressed alarm about an ammo shortage in Ukraine. Munitions are being used at an unsustainable rate. In an Orwellian twist, he claimed that the faster the ammunition can be produced, the more lives can be saved.
Key capabilities like ammunition, fuel, and spare parts must reach Ukraine before Russia can seize the initiative on the battlefield. It's urgent to provide Ukraine with more weapons. The faster we can deliver weapons, ammunition, spare parts, fuel to the Ukrainian front, the more lives we save.
Breaking today, Germany has made a deal to produce ammunition for the conflict. Interestingly, this means once again the world will see German bullets killing Russians en masse. Last night, a 43-year-old African-American man opened fire at Michigan State University, killing three.
I could hear gunshots, like, directly behind my head, and I could see the smoke, like gunpowder or something from the weapon firing, and then I could smell, and immediately I dropped to the floor with all my classmates, and someone was yelling that there was a shooter, and everybody needed to get down on the ground. And at that moment, I thought that I was gonna die.
There is a pandemic in America. This is a partly mentally ill country. A report that came out yesterday from the CDC makes the severity of the crisis clear. Teenage girls in particular are suffering. In addition, adolescents and teens who practice homosexuality are more depressed and mentally ill than other categories of teens. Increasingly, kids take to social media to express their feelings. But social media use appears to be making these situations worse. The research indicates that cyberbullying is driving some of these outcomes, and excessive screen time is itself linked to depression. In America, the answer to a mental health crisis is to medicate, medicate, medicate. The consequences of this attitude are reflected in a tragic case out of Duxbury, Massachusetts. There, a mother named Lindsay Clancy strangled her three children to death while under the influence of a cocktail of prescription medications.
He removed the bands and begged them to breathe. He continued to scream uncontrollably and screamed for officers to come to the basement. The dispatchers are hearing this and they send help down to the basement. And when they encounter Patrick, he yells out, "She killed the kids."
This woman was prescribed 13 different mood-altering prescriptions for her postpartum depression. The effect of those drugs was to turn her into a, quote, zombie. Daniel, we're so clearly in a mental health crisis. That's what's maybe most alarming, is that our ways of fixing the problems appear to be making it worse.
Yeah. Jonathan Haidt, the social scientist, just recently had a paper called The Teen Mental Health Crisis Began in 2012. And he talks about the usage of social media and how that's driving, mental illness, really. It's weaponizing it. And, for instance, all the challenges that they'll have kids do, like the licking toilet bowl challenge. And I'm not making that up, or eating cinnamon challenge, like all these things that can actually cause them to hurt themselves. And so there was a woman named, what was her name? Susan Greenfield, I think. And she wrote a book called Mind Change. And she was a neurophysiologist. And she was talking about the neurological changes that take place in the brain under the influence of social media and B.F. Skinnerian, kind of, reflex manipulation that these platforms can you know do regarding young people, especially young people as their brains are forming. And so yeah, so Jonathan Haidt, he noticed a clear connection between mental illness and the arrival of social media, which, by the way, the people who actually run these companies do not allow their children to use. Bill Gates famously like limited his children to an hour of the computer a day and did not allow them to go on social media. Same thing with the former president of Facebook, who was interviewed by The Guardian. He said that, you know, this is unethical and we're purposely depressing people, because when we depress them, basically they want to self-soothe, so they buy more things to self-soothe, so we flood them with ads after we've depressed them, and they're knowingly doing this.
And then you pile medication on top of it, which, and these meds that are for anti-depression, anti-anxiety, all have black box warnings about suicidal ideation. That's why we're seeing all of these child suicide rates are skyrocketing. Well, and I will say, too, from a nursing perspective, true clinical depression has to do, you know, like if a husband and wife, one of them is ill with a terminal illness and the other one is a caregiver, that caregiver will often suffer true clinical depression, where old hobbies are no longer of interest. You can't even taste food. All your food tastes like cardboard, even your favorite foods from days gone by have no allure to you. And that is a form of clinical depression that truly does need help. But these kids are getting depressed because of their behavior. It's not because of a chemical imbalance or anything like that that's going to be solved by.
They're being purposely depressed, like Facebook back in 2012. And I think we used this example the other day, where Mark Zuckerberg apologized for the it bears repeating that Mark Zuckerberg's degree at Harvard was pursuing a degree in psychology, not computer science. And so he was doing a giant psychology experiment. And so he knew that if you, for instance, were a fan of pets, if you had like PETA stuff on your page and stuff, he would start flooding your feed with animal cruelty videos. He knew if you were on the left, he would flood your feed with Donald Trump videos or vice versa, to purposely trigger depressive states to be able to market and sell things to people. Google has a white paper explicitly about this phenomenon, where they put people in stress situations. For instance, they'll be able to use geolocation on the phones and know if a bunch of people are in close proximity to each other. So if they're all the phone signals are close together, they know that you're in a subway car, or they know you're in an elevator, and they know that you're going to have increased levels of stress. You're likely to disappear, absent yourself inside your phone. So at that point, when you're in that stress position, with more ads. So this is, they've created algorithms about this. I wanted to touch something just really quickly too, just to circle back to the first story on Jens Stoltenberg. This bears repeating just really quickly, because the mental illness thing plus the drugs leading to shootings kind of reminded me of NATO and shootings and bullets. And there was a study recently that said that if we had a hot war in China, the United States would only have about enough bullets for a week. We're wasting all of our ammunition in the Ukraine. We're sending it all there. But I wanted to make this really quick point. Jens Stoltenberg used to be the prime minister of Norway. And so Norway was recently implicated in the Cy Hirsch story about the United States blowing up the Russian pipeline, Nord Stream 2. And so Jens Stoltenberg, who was the prime minister of Norway, then became the head of NATO. So he has an interested motive in kind of trying to cover this up, because Jens Stoltenberg, it was said in the Cy Hirsch article that what the United States did was an act of war against Russia, you know? And so the irony of Jens Stoltenberg talking about saving lives when he actually helped facilitate and coordinate an act of war, it's phenomenal sociopathy.
Orwellian, absolutely. And yesterday we discussed the train derailment in Ohio. Additional train derailments have been reported in South Carolina and Houston. At least one of those trains was transporting hazardous chemicals. This comes as reports are emerging that the recent train derailment in Ohio involved even more chemicals and carcinogens than initially reported. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg appeared yesterday. Our infrastructure is deteriorating before our eyes, but according to Buttigieg, one of our major problems in the country is what the guys in hard hats look like.
To work with your contractors, to work with your community colleges on building a workforce that reflects the community. We have heard way too many stories from generations past of infrastructure where you got a neighborhood, often a neighborhood of color, that finally sees the project come to them, but everyone in the hard hats on that project looking like, doing the good paying jobs, don't look like they came from anywhere near the neighborhood.
Right.
You can build community wealth that will help close wealth gaps in this country if we can tear down those barriers. But that happens at the delivery level.
This comes as Representative Jim Banks is contacting Pete Buttigieg over the reported covering of an artwork depicting Jesus Christ. The painting, titled Christ on the Water, memorializes sailors lost at sea and is displayed at the U.S. Marine Academy. It's the Merchant Marine Academy. It has been concealed to create a, quote, welcoming environment. Jim Banks is asking Buttigieg to act immediately to correct this. As far as we know, Mayor Pete hasn't addressed his concerns. Tim Scott is in the news. The Republican is planning to announce a run for president. His top issue is police reform, despite the fact that Scott knows that the modern defund the police era has failed.
The whole defund the police conversation that's been going on. And what we've seen is that, unfortunately, a lot of the cities have literally tried defunding the police to see if it works. The answer is, doesn't work very well. One of the reasons why we've seen since 2019 a 44% increase in homicides nationwide. 85% of that 44% increase have been African Americans and Hispanics. At the same time we've seen that increase, 70% more shootings of police officers.
Scott's priority is still being tough on police rather than tough on crime. And Tim Scott believes that racism is a pressing issue that needs a government response.
When you can't go for a jog as an African-American man, that questions whether or not your intrinsic value is on par with every other American. So we need to wrestle with these very significant issues. For those who believe that racism is dead and gone and that 99.9% of any group is pure, they're just living in a different universe.
We have more than 20,000 murders in America annually. On average, only half of those are solved. Daniel, how out of touch are these politicians?
Yeah, especially Tim Scott, who's from South Carolina, who, as the piece just said, is going to be running for president, as will Nikki Haley, also from South Carolina. She just announced today, by the way. But it bears repeating that Tim Scott is kind of the architect of the opportunity zones, the nominal architect in the Senate. And he worked very closely with a lot of, you know, key figures around. And when Black Lives Matter was destroying, you know, hundreds of cities around the country, I think it was 400 that there was like actually, you know, property damage. Catherine Austin Fitz, who was the former head of HUD, of Housing and Urban Development, noticed that they were just destroying the buildings in the opportunity zones. That Mr. Scott like said, okay, well, we're going to lay aside this location for African American businesses or Hispanic businesses or whatever, and give them choice real estate, and we'll give them grants and subsidies to do that. So ironically, as Black Lives Matter was, you know, shouting about Black justice, they were destroying Black businesses in these opportunity zones. And so Catherine Austin Fitz points out that the opportunity zones, number one, have been used for all sorts of nefarious things. There's a famous phrase that the CIA, that HUD is the CIA's candy store. They money launder through HUD, through real estate projects. And so there's been a lot of like narcotics trafficking through the opportunity zones, a lot of human trafficking, a lot of just nefarious stuff through the opportunity zones. And just the latest of which is destroying the opportunity zones and then, you know, making it rubble. And then rich people come in and buy it up for pennies on the dollar. And then they get HUD grants to kind of revitalize the place. So yeah, Tim Scott has a lot of answering to do regarding his ironic, attack the police kind of methodology. But also, you know, how does that play in with Black Lives Matter and these opportunity zones? I would love to see somebody question Mr. Scott about that.
Exactly. Well, and they always pull this race card, even when race has nothing to do with anything at all. It is very much it's just a ploy used by the left to stir up trouble and say, oh, there's trouble here where there isn't any trouble. And all of a sudden there are things that the government has to swoop in and solve. Supposedly, not really solve, just expand government power, right?
Yeah, it's just it's using it as a human shield so that you're not allowed to talk about, which is why the political left usually likes prized victim groups, whether it's Hillary Clinton, so that they can say, oh, we're in an age of misogyny, or Barack Obama, oh, we're suddenly in an age of racism, you know, right. Or a person in a wheelchair. We're in an age of ableism, so that they can have people who are above being questioned. You know, so that ironically in a republic victims. Is the biggest argument against having this, because we need politicians right. who are able to be questioned. And so they felt fully within their rights to question Trump. But when it comes to these issues, you can do all sorts of nefarious things, put a black human shield in front of it and go, oh, to question this narcotics trafficking or this human trafficking or the opportunity zones and the CIA's money laundering. Oh, you must be against African-Americans. So,
right.
Yeah, I think that's
exactly.
Mr. Scott's methodology.
You bet it is. Well, Daniel, thank you so much for those insights, and we will see everybody back on the other side of this break.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The Declaration of Independence proclaims God-given rights, and we intend to protect them. Working with people like you for over 50 years, preserving freedom and building a better tomorrow. Safeguarding the Constitution by limiting government power. We are restoring liberties, educating voters, and leading the freedom movement. Join with us. United, we will defend our rights. We are all Americans. We are the John Birch Society.
Sophia paused before the door. It read, Department of Bi-Digital Convergence. Just inside was a new world, a better world, the one of everlasting life, of no pain, of no loss, of no problem. She entered the chamber and her surroundings changed. She saw around her an infinite field of waving golden grain surmounted by cloudless blue sky. The AI voice whispered gently in her mind, Welcome to the singularity. She couldn't see it and couldn't feel it, but her body had almost instantly been covered by a swarm of tiny gray multi-legged bots that melted through her clothes and into her skin. Not perceiving the nightmare, her eyes had already been consumed and the rest of her body was dissolving as the bots digested her flesh. She felt only a warmth suffusing her being. Drowsy, she drifted to sleep, and her last thought was one of panic. Would she ever wake? Could a nightmare vision like this be an outcome of the much-hyped transhumanist technological singularity? Enter the world of the future as illuminated by the experience of the past in Endgame, the new book by Dennis Barrett, the publisher of The New American Magazine, and find out how the disastrous COVID pandemic response fits with the technocratic elite's thirst to create a transhumanist utopia. Get Endgame from shopjbs.org with free shipping with code ENDSHIP, E-N-D-S-H-I-P. Or get Endgame and the Great Reset Collector's Issue of The New American Magazine and get free shipping plus an additional 20% off both with code END20, END20.
Welcome back to The New American TV, where we report the truth behind the news. Brad Sheeda now serves as the executive director of Montana's Utility Regulatory Commission. But last year, when he was still serving in the Montana House, our own Alex Newman of The New American interviewed him about an Article 5 constitutional convention. We're going to pick up that interview in the middle of it and bring it to you because it's a wonderful educational tool to use to describe why a constitutional convention would be so very bad for our country. So let's take a look.
You're, I think, what is the true definition of a statesman. You did something, you saw that everything wasn't correct, and then you had the courage to actually walk it back, which, you know, a lot of politicians will double down or triple down, but you did not do that. You introduced the Convention of States bill in the Montana legislature, and after realizing that there were some concerns, you actually walked it back. Tell us about that whole ordeal.
Well, the term ordeal, I think, adequately describes it. That was in 2017, my sophomore session. And some folks had approached me, and I had not done my homework. And they asked me to carry the Convention of States bill. And it was one of those bills that you carry, but they come back to bite you because you have not done your homework, have not done enough exploratory assessment or evaluation, even though you're old enough to know better. And I certainly was. I was, I think, 62 at the time, and I figured I knew enough about it to be behind it. And as I took a look at it, I had not done enough homework. So I introduced the bill. It went through its first reading. We went down to committee, and I walked into the committee after having spent probably a week talking to people and doing my assessment evaluation, which should have been done much earlier, obviously. And I stepped to the podium and told folks I could not, in good conscience, carry the bill and support it. So I was in a room of people who were supportive of the COS and immediately became hostile to me, not openly aggressive and hostile, but hostile because they had been abandoned. And I think I deserved whatever disdain came from them because I should have told them up front that I was not going to carry the bill. And I waited intentionally in that room while the proponents or opponents and informational witnesses spoke, so that if anyone wanted to come up to me and tell me what they thought of me or of my abandoning them, that I would be there. And it was, I don't know that it was courageous, but it just felt like the right thing to do. So I simply stepped back from that bill, and it wound up dying in committee. And I was happy that it did, because for a number of reasons that you've explained in videos, and others with whom I've been speaking or from whom I've been reading have been telling me an awful lot of things about the COS that are just suspect. So.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Brad. And actually, I think in the second segment after the break, we'd like to air some of your remarks in the legislature when that happened. We've got a little 3-minute clip that's just fantastic. But what are some of your concerns with the Convention of States idea? I mean, we're being told that this is a way to rein in the federal government. And I think there's very few people in Montana or even in most of the what they call flyover country that would disagree on the need to rein in the federal government. But what made you think that maybe this wasn't the best way to do that?
Well, you know, as I said, after conducting my my research, and I think what we're going to do is change our family crest, perhaps, because it's currently ready, fire, aim, and we're trying to do things now that's reverse the order of the last two. What I found out were, you know, number one, why are they paying certain people to support the Convention of States? I mean, you see people like Mark Levin who are receiving monies for providing their support. And I have great respect for Mark Levin. I mean, he obviously has ascended to a level where most people only dream of being, you know, being recognized publicly. And there are others who have supported it. But what I found out was that, and I think you alluded to this at some point in time. I think I saw a video that you had done. And I've told people this for several years now. How do we expect a national, I'm gonna call them leader team, but elected members of the House and Senate to follow a new amendment to the Constitution if they're not currently following what the Constitution asks of them to do? So I really see that there's a difficulty getting people to change their minds, especially when they see no pain or no penalty for continuing to conduct themselves the way they have been. And then some of the proponents of the COS early on, as my research indicated, was that there were a lot of liberals who were trying to use that approach to get folks to sign on to it, and they found that wasn't working. So what do? You change strategy, you change course, and you find a new target audience, and that new target audience has become conservatives, because it sounds like such a great measure. I mean, we want to rein in federal government. We want to curtail their spending. We don't want them acting outside their constitutional responsibilities. But the bottom line is they continue to do that. So while we're all in favor of doing that, and I don't know anybody, no matter where they stand on the COS, nobody wants to see the federal government continue its trajectory. But what we're seeing now is that, you know, people are saying, you know, it's almost like when somebody's drowning. One of the things they tell you is don't try to fight to pull them up. If they're trying to pull you down, push them down, because that way they'll say, I've got to fight to get back up. So we have to kind of request or advise people to do the same research that you've been doing and that I've started to do, that you know, buddies of mine like Teresa Manzella have been doing for a long time, saying, wait a minute, this is not a good measure. So, and then, you know, the coup de grace of all of this is, why would George Soros be behind this and be financing or funding this? Because everything he does is to the detriment of America. So as far as I'm concerned, anything he has his hands in is something that I want to maintain a great distance from.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think a lot of people share those concerns about George Soros. And for those out there who aren't aware, who maybe haven't seen some of this research, George Soros has been very active in funding a number of groups that are supporting this use of the Article 5 Constitutional Convention as a way of changing the Constitution. These are radical left-wing groups, people like the guys at Wolfpack, the Young Turks. Interesting name they chose there. And also, you mentioned Senator Manzella. A wonderful lady. We've had her on the program here many times, and she actually has she sent a certified letter to Mark Meckler of the Convention of States saying, hey, why don't you come up here? We'll set up a debate in the legislature, and you can discuss with Robert Brown the different angles of this whole debate. And as far as I know, he has not yet responded. He has an open invitation on any of my programs as well. We've invited him repeatedly, but he has not come on. We did just have Congressman Andy Biggs come on The New American with my colleague Christian Gomez, and you know, he explained something that I think is critical that people are not understanding, and that is that Congress is the one that's going to call the convention, and that means, of course, Congress is going to decide how delegates are selected and all the rest of it. What do you think, Brad? Can we trust the current Congress, or even a Congress, say, hypothetically, the 22 election goes to Republicans? Can we trust them with putting together this kind of convention?
It's hard to really assess what my feelings are about the federal electorate, because I don't know a lot of them personally. If they were all like Matt Rosendale, I'd have no problem with it, because Matt has been a stalwart conservative. I mean, I have a great personal relationship with Matt. I can get on the phone and talk to him almost any time. And when Matt says I'm going to do something, he does it. And he's proven that throughout his career, both in state politics and now at the national level. But I look at people who are fair weather conservatives. When it's popular to jump on the bandwagon, they do that. I mean, I can't remember what the exact quote was, but they talked about, you know, when an initial group of people become patriotic, they're standing up against, you know, fire from both sides. But when patriotism becomes popular, then everybody hops on board. And that's oftentimes what we see. We see political figures who poll test everything and say, is this the right thing to do? Do the polls tell me that I should be doing it or not? And as far as I'm concerned, it's not real difficult. Look at what the Constitution tells you to do. Look at what your conscience tells you to do. Ask your constituents what they think you ought to do, and then do those kind of things. And don't be a person who measures their response based upon what they think is politically expedient for themselves or what they think might gain them the most traction. I've tried to the best of my ability while I've been in the legislature to make decisions that are going to benefit people in the state of Montana. So if you've got federal electorate that are going to be calling a convention, I know in the Senate there's 50 of them that I have very little likelihood I trust. And there's probably another 30 on the other side in the Republican caucus that I have some questions about. Maybe 20, but there's still a significant number. So the majority of the people there, I don't know that I have that great a trust in what they would wind up doing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you hit the nail on the head there with, you know, you just described perfectly, I think, the difference between a politician and a statesman. A statesman stands on principle. A statesman stands on the Constitution, not, 51% of the people think this today, so I guess I'll do that. So God bless you, Brad. We're going to go to a break in just a moment. When we get back, I want to talk about some of the solutions that are out there for the states to be able to work on reining in the federal government. And also, we'll air that clip of you speaking on the floor of the legislature there in Montana.
All right, we're ready to open the hearing on House Joint Resolution 8, brought to us by Representative Chita.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Brad Chita, TSCHIDA. Representing House District 97, which is West Missoula and the community of Lolo. My plan this morning was to bring a solid defense of House J or HJ 8 to you all. But after some reflection the last week or so and some new information that came to my attention, I realized that I had brought a number 2 Phillips screwdriver to a job where I needed a jackhammer. And I guess we can always do one of 2 things in these situations. We can staunchly defend why we took the position we did, even though we know it's wrong, and try to make a solid argument out of it. Or we can admit that we were wrong or used the wrong tool, had the wrong tool to try to address a matter. A resolution of states under Article 5 is not necessarily meant to change the behaviors of individuals that we know are inappropriate, or at least we believe to be inappropriate. It's actually meant, Article 5 is meant to correct deficiencies and errors in the Constitution. So if we attempt to correct a problem with the wrong tool, we wind up probably creating additional problems. So I have a practice in my family, and I try not to employ it all that often, called ready, fire, aim. And we do that on a number of occasions, and so I try to avoid that at all possible, if at all possible. This was not one of those cases. I walked right into the middle of something that I should have done a much better job of researching beforehand, but thinking that it would be an opportunity to keep alive something that would serve a tremendous purpose, I agreed to bring HJ 8 to this body, and I should not have done so. So what I am going to do is ask this group to vote against that particular resolution, because I think that there are more effective ways to curb a problem in Washington, D.C. than using this measure. One of the arguments that was used in opposition to any kind of measure to change the political scene in Washington, D.C. is that if you have a group of individuals who aren't following the current law anyway, what good does it do us to add one more law that they're going to ignore? And if we have the wrong process to bring a law that's going to potentially be ignored or may result in a negative action or a negative outcome, why do we do that? So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would ask that HJ 8 either be tabled or that if you do bring it up under a motion to do pass, that it not be passed in this committee, Mr. Chair.
All right, folks, some powerful words there. Brad, you know, a lot of people say, well, okay, if you don't want to do the Convention of States, well, what do you want to do? Obviously, you know, I think we all agree there's a real problem right now. What are some of the tools available to state legislatures and state legislators to try to deal with some of these unconstitutional usurpations coming out of Washington, D.C.?
Well, obviously, we have nullification is one of the first things that we can use at the state level. We can just, I mean, we're going through that right now. We had three federal judges that want to draw district lines for our public service commissioners, and we could not get a sufficient number of our caucus. We only got 50 out of 67 members to sign on to a letter that would say we would limit our a special session to a single issue, and that would be drawing the PSC district lines. And we couldn't get, there were 17 folks who are, you know, call them transpartisan, migratory Republican, whatever you want to call them. They wouldn't agree to participate. So we couldn't get enough momentum behind us to have a special session called. So unfortunately, we're going to leave it in the hands. We abdicated authority to federal judges. So we need to, as legislators, realize that we are probably the weakest body in the state, in the three branches of state government, and we need to exert power. We need to get on an exercise program that lifts us up and provides strengthening of who we are as a member of that three-legged stool of state government.
Yeah, and actually, that's exactly what the founder said, that the legislative branch needs to be the strongest of the three. They're the ones who are making the laws. So,
yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the other thing we need to do is concentrate on what's best for the people in the state of Montana. And I'm going to interject this. When I first ran in 2014, I came across something that's kind of become a mantra for me. And that was the difference between a politician and a public servant. And it said a politician is looking ahead to the next election, and a public servant is looking ahead to the next generation. And so my focus has been on the next generation. I don't need to have another addition to my resume. You know, people aren't going to say, okay, we're going to hire you for a job. I'm 68 years old. They're not going to hire me and go, okay, have you served in the legislature? Good. That's going to determine whether we hire you or not. So I went into this thinking that I wanted to make life to the best degree possible in Montana better for my kids and grandchildren and for those of everybody else that I represent, not just the people in my House district, but across the state, because the decisions that we make as individual legislators don't just affect a particular part of the state. They affect the entire state. And so that's our job.
Yeah, absolutely. And Brad, one of the issues that you worked on, I think in the last session, was the out of control big tech companies censoring and silencing and canceling people whose views they disagree with, conservatives, Christians. Talk a little bit about that and how you see a role for state governments in trying to rein some of that in.
Well, I think we have an awful lot of power at the state level to be able to look at those big tech corporations and say, no, you can't do that in our state. And we worked with a gentleman who's not an attorney, but a very brilliant guy out of Arizona. And Marty put together a real interesting plan of attack. Unfortunately, we had 48 or 49 of our 67 Republican electorate who voted for the measure. So of the three members who, or other two members in Missoula, because there's three elected members from Missoula have an R after their name. The other two, one of them voted for it and the other one voted against it. And I think one of, you know, the one that voted against it was following the cues of somebody that they shouldn't have been. So we need to look at what is good for our citizens. And tech censorship is absolutely not good, because they are putting their foot on the scale for one side of the electorate, that being the liberals, and saying, conservatives, you don't have a place here. Your voice is not important enough for us to hear you. So they're censoring us. So we need, you know, we need to get I'm going to bring that bill back, presuming I'm elected to Senate District 49. I'm going to bring that bill back and run it again and see what kind of luck we have.
Fantastic. Yeah, actually, just yesterday I was talking to Dr. Robert Malone, who broke the internet when he went on Joe Rogan's podcast. He said, this is so dangerous to have, you know, big tech companies in Silicon Valley deciding what we can discuss and share and learn about medicine, about science. I mean, you know, lives can literally be put at risk when you're silencing an entire side in a debate. It's just unbelievable.
It's so interesting that Representative Shida saw the truth after he had already introduced a bill to call for a constitutional convention, and then he saw the danger and withdrew that. So we are going to take a break here, and we will see you back for some legislative updates.
As a lumberjack, I've been cutting wood for decades. My job is pretty straightforward. I see the wood, I chop the wood. My axe goes through every time. You remember when everyone bought all the toilet paper? And they wanted me to wear these things. And someone invested a lot of money into this stuff. They say I'm part of a global plan. I don't think so. It's too hot, it's too cold. You know what? The weather changes. We even hear crazy ideas on how kids should learn.
Here's the news, Dad.
Is it, son? Is it?
What about this one, Dad?
Nope. It's hard to tell what's real and what's fake these days. There's just too much baloney out there. At the New American, they cut through the baloney and give me the truth.
Visit thenewamerican.com and subscribe to get 50% off the cover price. And if you want an even better deal, use the promo code 10OFFSUB. Again, that's 10OFFSUB for more than 50% off.
Welcome back to The New American TV, where we report the truth behind the news. Of course, there are a lot of people talking about World War III in regard to Ukraine. There's some interesting developments legislatively when it comes to that topic. And with joining me now from our studio in Appleton, Wisconsin, are Christian Gomez and Ben Faulkner. Hello, gentlemen. Thank you for being on the program.
Thank you for having us.
Absolutely. Well, go ahead and let's dive into this. This is a very important development on Capitol Hill in regard to Ukraine.
Yes. Yeah, so on February 9th, Congressman Matt Gaetz of Florida introduced H.R.E.S. 113. And it's a resolution that the first line says, expressing the sense of the House of Representatives that the United States must end its military and financial aid to Ukraine and urge all combatants to reach a peace agreement, right there in the first line under the word resolution. So this is a significant resolution that's been introduced because it backs the principle of non-interventionism, which is what the Founding Fathers urged and heeded that we would follow in future generations to their posterity. So the bill, as of right now, actually has 10 co-sponsors, congressmen. So in addition to the lead sponsor, who is Congressman Matt Gaetz. The other co-sponsors, of course, you see Matt Gaetz there on the screen. The other co-sponsors, by the way, are Andy Biggs, Paul Gosar, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Thomas Massey, Ralph Norman, Matthew Rosendale, Mary Miller, Anna Paulina Luna, Barry Moore, and Lauren Boebert of Colorado. So obviously we need to get much more co-sponsors for this bill. Of course, with it being a sense of resolution, it doesn't have the power to necessarily prohibit President Biden from stopping the military aid he's doing. But nevertheless, this is an important piece of legislation because if it were to pass in Congress, for full majority in the House and Senate, you would think that the same majority that would theoretically pass something like this would stop giving all this unconstitutional aid to Ukraine.
Right.
It's unfortunate that we only have 10 co-sponsors. What should people do about contacting their own congressman?
We don't have an alert out yet on JBS.org, but we will in the next few days. So be out on the lookout for that on JBS.org/alerts. It'll be under the federal alerts. But we're going to have a pre-written alert there that is editable and people can send to their state, to their federal legislators, to their congressmen, the U.S. House of Representatives and senators, that is, urging them to support the resolution so we can get much more co-sponsors and a Senate companion to this very important bill.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I was just going to add that it's critically important that this bill pass. As we've seen since 1945, all of these American interventions have really been unsuccessful. And I think now, Christian and I were just discussing this, but it seems like the goal now for America is to basically drag Russia into a kind of quagmire that will drain their resources and, you know, make Russia look bad on the international stage. But at the cost of Ukrainian lives and at the cost of Russian lives, and we don't want to see chaos, and we don't want to see this kind of failed strategy that's, you know, so often come from the Pentagon and the DOD. So let's end this conflict. Let's make peace with Russia. The John Birch Society has very strongly always been on the side of peace. We've kind of been controversial in the past. When Vietnam hawks were out there in the media saying that we needed to be in Asia, we were against it. We were against the war in Afghanistan, the war in Iraq. We were right. And I think we're right again that these wars are not in the best interest of the American people or the people of the world more generally.
Absolutely. Rebecca, earlier in the program, you mentioned the Nord Stream pipeline. And even in introducing us, you mentioned World War III. Well, last time I checked, the Congress hasn't issued a declaration of war against Russia, nor are we officially in a third world war. But I don't think President Biden has received that memo with this attack that was authorized on the Nord Stream pipeline and so forth. So we have a situation right now in Ukraine where there are American munitions, American tanks, American resources are being used, and maybe even American soldiers, who knows, maybe covertly, could be there as well. There's indications that that could be the case. We don't officially know. But this could certainly escalate into a third world war, mm-hmm. a war that the American people haven't urged Congress to be involved in. So it's very imperative that we pull out before we get dragged into an undeclared, mm-hmm. unconstitutional, protracted war, especially with a nuclear power like Russia. This is foolhardy.
Well, exactly. And also the track through history that Ben just took us on, the result of each one of those wars has been more centralized power, more power in the hands of the United Nations, more ceding our military to United Nations command. So we know that, and we know the Great Reset is the goal. They've declared that already. This is all, wouldn't you say this is all part of that?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'd agree. Also, take a look at how we pulled out of Afghanistan. It was utterly undignified. We gave enormous quantities of vehicles and ammunition, weapons, etc., to enemy forces. But so often what you see is that war really is a racket. There was a book by that title written several decades ago. But these military contractors get very wealthy off of these conflicts, and so much of what is occurring is really done for a kind of profit motive, and that may be the case in Ukraine now. We don't really have hard evidence of that, but if the past is to kind of predict the future, there is, these military contractors are probably doing well as a result of this conflict. So we think it's imperative that we get out of this, get out of this region.
Absolutely.
Right, absolutely. And Kristen, did you say that there were some state measures that mimic this federal resolution?
Yes. There are these bills that have been introduced in various state legislatures. They're referred to as Defend the Guard Act, and they've been introduced in the states of Arizona, Kansas, Missouri, New Hampshire, Oklahoma, Texas, West Virginia, and Wyoming. We need more states to introduce these bills, but what these bills would do, they would prohibit combat deployments of those particular states' national guards by the federal government in the absence of a congressional declaration of war. Like right now, we're involved in Ukraine, there's no declaration of war. So this would really hamper the ability of Biden or the federal government to send state national guard forces. Whether they're being sent on the border of Ukraine, like on the Polish side, or even in Ukraine, it's essential that states pass these resolutions to prohibit the federal government from dragging us into a protracted conflict. So these resolutions would help. And lastly, that last point I want to make, on top of all of these measures from Gates and the states that we're seeing, I would urge Congress to also consider getting us out of NATO, because ultimately all that NATO does is it threatens our national security, because our forces have to be committed to defend the borders of other countries when, Lord forbid, I mean, right now we're seeing all these balloons and so-called UFOs. What if the Chinese or Russian Air Force theoretically decides to invade U.S. and Canadian airspace, but all of our military assets are over in Europe? It would take hours, days, weeks to get them back to the U.S., and by that point, it could be too late. So it would heed our national security. It would be much more efficient for our national security if our forces were here in the United States and not in Europe elsewhere.
Our republic is not designed to be involved in all these foreign entanglements, and we should really be looking at what we can do for people at home. Clearly, we are in a kind of moment of deterioration in this country. How can we improve life for Americans? That needs to be paramount in the thinking of our politicians. It needs to be paramount in the thinking of the people of this country. So that's all our right. attitude.
All of these bills are available at jbs.org, and we will see everybody back on the other after these messages.
If Americans want to remain a free and sovereign nation, more people need to understand the principles and values that built this great nation. At the John Birch Society, we have the organization, the plan, and the resources to do just that. Our founder, Robert Welch, said, "Education is our total strategy and truth our only weapon." Go to jbs.org to learn more, including how you can get involved to work locally and impact nationally. Join the John Birch Society today.
Here's the news, Dad.
Is it, son? Is it?
What about this one, Dad?
Nope. It's hard to tell what's real and what's fake these days. There's just too much baloney out there. At the New American, they cut through the baloney and give me the truth.
The truth is hard to find, but the New American has it. Check it out at thenewamerican.com.
All right, parents, listen up. We've all seen the countless examples of how radical leftists have been destroying American schools. It's no longer just about the terrible math and reading levels. Now radical left teachers birthed from liberal universities are forcing gender indoctrination in kindergarten. They're teaching lessons on white guilt.
Freedom Project Academy has perfected live online learning over the course of a decade. I get a ton of great feedback about this program, a ton.
They're built on Judeo-Christian values, a classical curriculum. What does that mean? It means they're taught, your children are taught the way that the founding generations of the country. My own son Noah did Freedom Project Academy for several years when he was younger.
The more we tell our friends about these things, the more people will get on board, and I believe that we can be the catalyst to some real change.
We must save the West. Our way of life and our culture is under attack, and because of patriots like you and your project, I have optimism for the future.
Recently, I sat down with the National Events Coordinator of the John Birch Society, Ms. Lisa von Gildern. She had some keen insights about all of the calls for a constitutional convention across the country. Let's have a listen. Thanks for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you, Rebecca. This is
great to have you.
Great issue to be talking about, because it drives home the point that the Constitution is the solution to all our federal and ills across this country, if we could only follow the Constitution.
Right, absolutely. It shackles the federal government. It's not supposed to shackle us as free individuals. It's a list of thou shalt nots, or at least the Bill of Rights is, a list of thou shalt nots for the government, not for people. And the Constitution
unfortunately
itself,
people have no idea. They keep thinking that we need to change the Constitution because the government, they want change from the government. And the problem is the government is completely ignoring the limits that were placed upon them by our founders. They have so exceeded their authority, and people are frustrated and unhappy. So what they want to do is they want to change the rules, not realizing that the federal government is not playing by the rules.
Yeah, absolutely. Now this group, Convention of States, is using some pretty sneaky tactics you were describing to me before we went on air here. So let's get back into that.
Well, JBS is a member-run organization, really. It's a grassroots organization. And the members are the ones who we help educate and teach to go and fight the battles. And one of the battles is the Convention of States is trying to get all the states to apply for a convention. Well, the three quarters required, or two thirds. I'm sorry, I'm feeling like an idiot right now, but the they're trying to get the required number of signatures on the states to apply to the Congress for a convention in order to change our Constitution. The problem is that they're deceptive. They tell people that we need a balanced budget amendment or we need term limits. And they don't tell them that if we apply for a convention, you might lose your Second Amendment rights or free speech, which we're already struggling to maintain. So the Convention of States is an organization that is funded to the tune of millions of dollars annually. And we are a small grassroots organization trying to educate our fellow citizens and our legislators about the dangers of things like a constitutional convention. What I ran to in Arizona is we already have two applications for a constitutional convention put forth previously, and we're trying to get a rescission bill through the legislature to rescind all previous calls. The legislator that I had go, he's a new legislator, he took the rescission language and he was whipping support for his bill and he called me. He was talking to another new legislator and they told him, oh, I can't support that because I signed a pledge to Convention of States. My legislator called me and said, Lisa, I'm sorry, I can't carry this bill. He was heartbroken because he knows about the dangers of a constitutional convention. And he told me he signed a pledge to support term limits, as did several other of the legislators that I love and adore. They're America First freedom advocates who truly believe in supporting the Constitution. So I'm working with them because I believe that they were not fully informed. It's kind of like the whole COVID crisis. We need to be fully informed before we take a medical intervention. We need informed consent. And COS just comes up and says, oh, don't you want term limits? And they sign this pledge, not realizing that that's going to lead to a loss of the Constitution of our United States.
Now, what does the pledge actually say? Have you seen this pledge?
I asked for a copy. Hang on. I'm going to see what they sent me. He said it was just a pledge to support the COS for term limits, nothing else in return.
Nothing else. So they're using term limits or balanced budget amendment. What have people forgotten that we have? Now, I'm not advocating for amending the Constitution with either of those measures, but have people forgotten that we already have that plan in place to add amendments to the Constitution? Why do we need a convention of states?
Well, people are told it's the only way. In fact, when I was first discussing him running this rescission bill, I got questions back from him like, well, don't the state legislators decide who's going to represent us if there is a convention? And I had to educate him about the fact that that's not true. If California has 55 congresspeople and a small state like Montana or Wyoming has three, guess who's going to win? Congress is going to decide the rules of the game, and then they're going to vote for themselves what they want. And right. I really can't see our smaller states with fewer legislators defeating what's going on when you pull California and New York and some of the larger, more liberal areas in.
So what is the John Birch Society doing to educate not only the electorate, but especially our elected officials? It sounds like they're woefully misinformed on this issue.
Well, I will say I did talk to my legislators, but they'd already been elected and succeeded, and we were cheering them on. What happened, and this is what my legislator told me, is the minute he pulled papers for his run is when COS approached them. They didn't wait until after he won the primary. They went after them the minute they pulled papers to run. So anybody who is running is being approached by COS. And I think what's really important for people to know is that they need to approach their legislators, potential legislators, candidates. And we had a good team up in the Phoenix area. Sitting candidates down and having them sit through the Constitution is the solution. And we need more of that everywhere. But we need to be talking to them and educating them about the Article 5 dangers mm-hmm. the minute they start indicating they want to run. And the place to do that might be in their local, whether it's Libertarian, Republican, or Democrat, legislative districts. And in those meetings, they need to educate those people about the dangers of a constitutional convention. He was lied to about the dangers and about the fact that it would be the state that would decide how the convention was run.
Right. And it is so important for people to become that go-to for anyone who's running for office or who already has office, especially locally. You have so much of a smoother line of communication with your locally elected and state elected representatives, and become that go-to. Make yourself known as the expert on the Constitution. We have the video series that you referenced, The Constitution is the Solution, is available in its entirety at jbs.org, and we encourage everyone to visit there and view those. We'll be showing portions of that on this program in future episodes too. You and I were talking before we went on air too about a presentation at the JBS Leadership Conference last year in September, I believe it
There's
was.
There's two videos I want to point out to people. There was a presentation last year at the Leadership Conference by Senator Southworth from Kentucky on how to work with your legislature, and it was fantastic. And I've used it with people in Arizona to help teach them the importance of being ahead of the game. You don't wait till they've dropped the bills and start speaking out. You need to be talking to them months beforehand. The second piece, I group texted a couple of my legislators last night, actually, and because I was concerned about this, and they're all three in support of term limits to one degree or another, but they're not in support of a con. And I sent them a video. Alex Newman did an interview with Brad Tshida, that's T-S-C-H-I-D-A. Brad Tshida in Montana, he actually proposed a bill supporting the con, and then he later realized the danger of it, and he got up when it was time to vote and disavowed his own bill and said he couldn't support it. It's a fabulous video, and you can find it at thenewamerican.com. These things are so important for people to understand and be educated on. I can't urge it strongly enough for anyone, JBS member or regular citizen, come join us in the fight to preserve the Republic.
Amen. I will give you two thumbs up on that. We need everyone. We need more pullers at the oars, as founder Robert Welch once said. So, Lisa, we're out of time, but thank you so much. This is extremely important for our very way of life, for our survival as a country, and I appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Rebecca.
And we are out of time for this edition of The New American TV. We'll look forward to seeing you again tomorrow.